Good morning. Welcome to the Roundtable. We're full of love this morning on this edition of the Roundtable. It's the 24th of July, 14 minutes past 9 o'clock, and we do love having you with us, and we would love to hear your thoughts on what we're going to talk about this morning. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. I hope you are well. We have lots to talk about today, and we will get right to it. Let me introduce the group to you. Joseph Powell Mountain Chair in Government at Skidmore College. Bo Breslin is here. Good morning, Bo. How are you?
I'm well, Joe. Thanks. Thanks again for having me.
Very nice to have you here. Always nice to have you here. We also welcome Vice President for Editorial Development, former Vice President for Editorial Development at the New York Press Association, longtime editor at the Daily Gazette. Good morning, Judy Patrick.
What a beautiful morning, isn't it? It's just, there are so many mornings I come down here and I, you know, slosh through slush, chip ice off my windshield, come through the rain, put on three layers. Oh, man, but today, just glorious.
In fact, I was just driving. I left early with the idea that I had things to do when I got here, but instead I just started driving around the mountain roads because I had the time and it was beautiful, absolutely gorgeous. The sun was perfect and got to take pictures and saw lots of fawns and a fox or two, and it was very cool. So yes, beautiful weather as it has been. I know it's going to get hot, but we'll deal with that when the time comes. Senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, Robert Pandicio is here. Good morning, Robert. How are you?
I am well and in pain.
Oh.
If I'm going to be really honest.
So not well.
No, this is the downside of good weather. I've been helping a neighbor take in his hay this week.
Oh.
And that is real work.
That's a job.
My oh, my goodness. I am feeling every day of my 62 years right now.
That's friendship, man. That's really good.
Yeah.
That's
thanks.
Really good.
Thanks. No, I'm happy to do it, and it's honest work, but I'm feeling it this morning.
We have a couple dozen acres in the front of the house that's hayed. Mm-hmm. And there is no greater thrill than to see whatever farmer shows up to go in and to take care of that and to bring it out.
It's so pretty until you have to stack it in the barn.
Yeah, that's all lost on me. That's great.
Yeah,
just, they get the hay, we get the ag discount. All's good.
Exactly.
Everything's great.
And I get the workout.
That's right. Well, yeah. Good morning, all. It's a delight to have you all here. Okay, we have a lot to talk about, and we'll get right to it and figure out what we want to. We could do these stories in a couple different ways, but I think what I would like to start out with is Columbia University. The Columbia University decided yesterday that they were going to settle, and they agreed to a $200 million fine to settle their fight with the President of the United States, Donald Trump. This has been going on, as it has in other high-level higher education institutions across the country. The White House had canceled more than $400 million in research funding to the university, saying it had failed to protect Jewish students from harassment. Columbia University will now pay a $200 million fine to settle allegations from the Trump administration that it failed to do enough to stop the harassment, part of a sweeping deal reached on Wednesday to restore the university's federal research funding, according to a statement from the university. In exchange for the return of hundreds of millions in research grants, Columbia will also pledge to follow laws banning the consideration of race in admissions and hiring, and follow through on other commitments to reduce anti-Semitism and unrest on campus that it agreed to in March of this year. The deal, which settles more than a half dozen open civil rights investigations into Columbia University, will be overseen by an independent monitor agreed to by both sides, who will report to the government on its progress every 6 months. Columbia will also pay $21 million to settle investigations brought by the U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. And not for nothing, I think we should mention that this comes as Harvard University spent the first 2 days of this week in court suing the Trump administration over the actions taken against their university. Robert.
Oh, you sure you want to start with me, Joe?
Yes.
Because, excuse me.
You're all hayed up. Let's go.
Exactly. Can you hear it? I'm probably going to give an unpopular answer. My answer is good. I think there's a tendency to view anything coming out of the Trump administration. If Trump likes it, I don't like it. Therefore, I don't like this settlement. But come on, Columbia has not crowned itself in glory. With the so-called tent afada, with the protest, the violent takeover of the library, the boxcar number of students who legitimately complained, Jewish students, that they felt unsafe on campus. Regardless of what one thinks of Donald Trump, this is a legitimate case, and I'm not sorry. I'm having trouble finding fault with it. Let's put it that way.
All right, Bo Breslin.
Yeah, that is unpopular in the room. There's a lot to it. So Columbia gained a lot from this agreement, and let's just go over the list of things that Columbia gained from this particular agreement. In addition to getting the $400 million back, the government agreed not to be involved in hiring decisions or admissions decisions. The government will not pursue Columbia for violations of free speech. The government will permit Columbia to compete for grants. As Joe, you mentioned, the civil litigation goes away. All that said, Columbia came out the big loser in this whole moment for a variety of reasons, right? One is, and I'm curious what Judy has to say about this, the headlines are all that Columbia capitulated and had to pay the $200 million. Now, as I said, they got some stuff from it, but a couple of things that are worth mentioning. One, the president of Columbia is a member of the Board of Trustees Board of Trustees typically in a college and university have two responsibilities: pick a president and make sure the fiduciary make sure the fiscal health of the college or university is in place. It is not a surprise to me that the $400 million was so important to them that they were willing to capitulate in a way that I think is damaging for higher institutions generally. Robert, you mentioned all of the things that happened at Columbia with regard to the tents and the takeovers and all that sort of stuff. That's part of college, the history of college. You cannot go through much of higher education in the last 70 years without touching upon takeovers of particular buildings. It's part of the coming of age experience. And I think if you do it nonviolently, as most people do, then I think it's part of that whole educational process.
But
I'll say two other quick things. Faculty at Columbia and across higher education are now on notice, because Columbia paid $200 million, that they should watch out for their syllabus, because there are going to be other things that are coming down the road. And there was a great op-ed, last thing I'll say, great op-ed yesterday about this, that suggests, in the New York Times, that suggests, why do we believe that the government will abide by this agreement? There's nothing to suggest that the government's agreements in the past, under the Trump administration, they abide by it. So I actually think Columbia came out the big loser here, and higher education is damaged, maybe not irreparably.
So on that note,
yeah,
what do you think if you're Harvard or another major college that is on the fray and is dealing with these issues and perhaps going to be dealing with these issues with the administration. How do you feel about what Columbia did? Because there was initially this pact, we're all going to work together, this is obscene, this is horrible, what are you doing? And then suddenly you turn around and say, okay, we'll take the deal.
Yeah, so I'm not surprised that Columbia took the deal, but what I would have done on day one, if I were president of Columbia, is figure out a way to come up with, and they have an incredible endowment, figure out a way to come up with at least $400 million and turn your back on the threats that came from the White House.
Bo, right? Can I ask, what would you have done on day one of the protests when they turned violent?
Well,
I mean, I agree with you that, sure, protests will always be with us, but can we not agree that there were several instances at Columbia that just crossed the line?
I don't disagree with you, Robert, that Columbia had the worst sort of experience with anti-Semitism among colleges and universities in the country.
The worst look, too.
The worst look.
I mean,
I think it was more than a look, Joe. I mean,
I'm saying that it was. I understand what you're saying, and you're not wrong. But as far as on television, students barricaded in buildings.
Right. They took hostages at
2 feet coming out, dangling out of the. You know, what I mean by.
I just don't want to minimize it.
Yeah, okay.
I'm not minimizing it. I'm suggesting that Columbia has to A, change policies, which they did, and B, mea culpa till they're blue in the face.
Yeah.
But if you capitulate to a government that's going to control the institution in the way that the Trump administration wants to control the higher institutions of repute in this country, Columbia, Cornell, Harvard, Penn, Stanford, and so on, higher ed, and you're in the education space. Higher ed is going to be damaged irreparably, in my opinion. And, you know, I mean, at Skidmore, we've sort of flown under the radar.
Mm-hmm.
But there's no guarantee that we'll fly under the radar. And in that moment, I think you have to be vigilant about the mission of higher education.
Well, and how cynical, I mean, I'll be cynical, but why would any institution think they could fly under the radar when deals like these are reached?
Yeah, exactly. I think I don't think that's cynical. I think that's accurate.
Judy Patrick.
Yeah, let's call this for what it is. This isn't about anti-Semitism. I mean, this is the administration that said there were good people on both sides when people were in, what, North Carolina or
Charlottesville.
How could I have forgotten that? They are using anti-Semitism as a ruse to clamp down on academic freedom at institutions of higher learning. It's easy to blame Columbia for caving, and they did. I listened to the president of Columbia on CNN this morning, and when she was talking about it, you know, she said it was all about the money. It was all about the grants. It was all about the good work that they do with the research and the grants and the, you know, the higher learning. And she did identify this. She did not identify the problem that they solved. They could have solved the problem on their own. Certainly there were problems during the protests, but I agree with both. I mean, protests is a long-standing part of and dissent is a longstanding part of academic life, especially at the larger institutions. This is a real effort by Project 2025, this Project Esther that's related to it, to use anti-Semitism, again, as a red herring to do the things they want to do. They just want these institutions of higher education to be a place where old white men get to rule. And let's go back to the 1950s. Let's not have, you know, let's not bring people of different backgrounds, different colors into our campuses. Let's just go back to homogenized America. And I just believe that, you know, all this, you know, sophisticated intellectual talk about, overseeing things, it's just not going to happen. Columbia is sadly mistaken if they think that the Trump administration is not going to come back at them. They're going to have a monitor there going over their Middle Eastern studies. This is madness.
I don't think this is going back to the 1950s. I think it's going back to the 1930s when Jewish students were not welcome on college campuses. campuses. And I hate to be a broken record, and I don't like disagreeing, you know, so vociferously with my roundtable fellow panelists. But you got to remember, Columbia is not the victim here. Jewish students were the victim at Columbia. They were harassed. They were shouted down. They were physically threatened. I can't recall if this was at Columbia or a different university, but it happened at quite a few universities where Jewish students were literally advised to not be outwardly Jewish, to not wear religious garb. On a college campus in 2025, come on.
Shame on those college students who shouted down and did all the things you're talking about. That said, is it not inappropriate for the government to be involved in things like Judy's talking about, monitoring a Middle East studies program? That is, you talk
is
about...
Is that part of the deal? I have not gone over the...
Yes.
I'll tell you what bothers me about this deal, and it's a technical matter. I was very surprised, and again, I work in education. Granted, I do K-12, not higher ed. But when the whole issue of research grants came up, I was shocked at the amount of overhead that is built into these grants. So the thing I was looking for in this agreement was, are they capping the overhead? Because it's, you know, we are financing universities. It's not just the research. It's, I think, 60% of it goes to university overhead. I would have liked to have seen that, frankly, in this agreement.
I was dean of the faculty at Skidmore from 2011 to 2018, so I oversaw that office. That's high. It's not 60%. That said, there's never enough money, whether it's government-funded, Mellon Foundation, other foundations, there's never enough money for the type of research that does benefit the common good for faculty. And so when they start to strip that away, you've got to basically hold an institution hostage. That is sort of crossing the line.
The one thing that you've said, Bo, that I'd love to agree with you on is that, these universities have incredible endowments. You're right. I'm uncomfortable with government interference in curriculum, as it were. But sure, they have enough money that they could just say, no, we're good. We're going to finance this on our own.
How does this not interfere with curriculum, though?
No. I'm agreeing with Bo that I get uncomfortable when government imposes itself on what students do.
Got it. I want to go back to something Judy mentioned, and that is this idea of, you know that the Trump administration isn't going to go away. It's not like they're not going to stop going after Columbia University. At least there's no reason to believe that they will. Maybe this is a separate example and not a good example, but you think of Lisa Murkowski. What does it take to get Lisa Murkowski to vote on the big, beautiful bill? We're going to give you this. 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 Okay, I'm going to vote. Hey, I want those things. No, we're not going to give them to you.
Exactly.
So I just wonder, you know, it just seems like that's the same playbook.
Yeah, and you know me, it is the same playbook, and Judy's right about it. I think the among the many problems is, as you say, no reason to think that they're going to stick to this particular agreement. And it's just, we have so many institutions of higher education in this country, he can just pivot to another institution, play the same game, Trump I'm talking about, play the same game, and all of a sudden you're in a situation in which, you know, Cornell or University of Chicago, not University of Chicago, conservative institution, but has to play by the rules. That's why we should all be celebrating Harvard's attempt to fight the good fight here. At the end of the day, Harvard needs the billions of dollars that they're getting, that's being removed from their research funding, but they're fighting the good fight, and as a result, I think Harvard comes out smelling well, and Columbia smells poorly.
Can I ask? I'm going to appoint you Secretary of Education. If you're Secretary of Education, at least for now, the Office of Civil Rights is under the USDOE. Mm-hmm. How tell me your playbook here. How seriously do you take civil rights enforcement under Title VI?
I think you're Robert. I'm just going to assume something, and I love being this is the second time we've been on the show together, and I love being on the show with you. You're assuming that I somehow am giving a free pass to those who
that's why I'm asking you, where is the bar? In other words, the reason I said at the top, I'm looking for finding fault in this agreement, and I'm not finding it. You've made several good points. But at the end of the day, I can't see around the civil rights enforcement issue.
And my argument would be the OCR worked reasonably well, not perfectly, but reasonably well under the Biden and previous administrations.
Yeah. But don't you think it failed totally at Columbia?
I think there were problems at Columbia that are beyond the pale.
Yeah, okay.
I will admit that. I'm a big fan of internal justice, if you will, within the institution, and Columbia failed mightily on that regard.
Okay.
But if it rises to the level of OCR, OCR was working effectively for the last 20 years, and all of a sudden now it's not an effective institution. I don't agree with that.
This is to settle an OCR complaint, right?
Yes.
Okay. So it is working.
Well,
I think that, for example, the Department of Justice would come into a local police department if they found that the police agencies were discriminating. But there was no heavy-handed, we're going to find you, we're going to fine the city $500 million on unrelated programs if you don't comply with us. There has in the past been this mutual discussion of what the problems were, typically a minor fine. I mean, they were talking about putting Columbia out of business by what was being proposed. So it wasn't just we want to solve this problem. It was we want to put you out of business unless you cave to our every need. And as a result, they get to claim some sort of public relations win because Trump has clamped down on anti-Semitism when he hasn't, and people who view agencies or institutions like Columbia as elitist, they get to say, yeah, we knocked them down a peg.
So, Bo, let me ask you this question before we go to a break, and I don't expect you to have the answers or the numbers at the top of your head, but I am interested.
But maybe he does.
He probably does. He probably does. But $200 million, what impact does that have on the students of Columbia?
It'll have significant impact, especially the graduate students. So I don't know the particular numbers, but you're talking about hundreds of students that are being funded by these by the $200 million that Columbia has to pay, or the $400 million that the government still probably could figure out a way to withhold from Columbia. Hundreds of graduate students who are at some level of master's and PhD work, and I'm not even talking about the undergraduates. The curriculum is affected by this, Joe, but the reality is they are out of work now. And the ripple effect, the ripple effect of this, Joe, is significant because not just what the media does a very good job of covering, which is, some of the research, especially around health, is being either delayed or stopped. But you have all sorts of people that are existent in those institutions, like offices of sponsored research and so on, that are going to be let go because of the fact that $200 million helped to pay their salary. So it's not just students, it's employees at Columbia, it's the long-term ramifications of scholarship that goes away. This is a real problem for, quite frankly, the United States, which has the greatest higher education industry in the world.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We'll welcome you and Wetter's panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We'll be back right after this. Good morning. Sorry for the pause. I was just counting the letters. here we go. Welcome. Good morning. Welcome back to the show. We're talking about Columbia University agreeing to a $200 million fine to settle their fight with the Trump administration. We go to Sue, said, okay, so where do all those millions of dollars go to? All right. We don't know. I don't think we know that, do we?
Yeah, I don't. I mean,
I assume the U.S. Treasury. The U.S.
Yeah, at least in this case, they're not going to the Trump Library.
Yes. Exactly.
I'm sorry, says Amy. I understand there was anti-Semitism at Columbia after October 7th, and I absolutely condemn that. But the president has said countless anti-Semitic statements since he's been on the political scene, one being just a couple of weeks ago when he was boasting about his big, stupid bill. Fine if you want to be cool with the settlement, but let's not pretend that this is about anti-Semitism. This is about Trump's control over higher education. And don't for one second think that Trump won't try to go further. That from Amy. And group, just feel free to jump in whenever you whenever you want.
Agreed, Amy.
Joseph says it's a protection racket, pay up or else. Then we go to Robert. Not the one on our program. For the sake of argument, let's say certain protests were indeed out of line. Why does that mean that the federal government holds back needed critical public scientific research money? What does one have to do with the other? It's obviously an excuse to be in a, quote, deal-making position with the school to get one's way.
My answer to that, Joe, would be either you take civil rights enforcement seriously or not at all. Pick one.
John writes, Trump is a neo-fascist surrounded by neo-fascists who don't give a rat's left whisker about anti-Semitism and are using Jews to push their neo-fascist agenda. These attacks on universities, shouty caps, have nothing whatsoever to do with what happened to Jewish students at Columbia University and, shouty caps, everything to do with, shouty caps, enforcing white supremacy and segregation to U.S. universities. Remember, the opposite of DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion, is uniformity, inequality, and exclusion. In other words, white supremacy and whites-only segregation. That from John.
I think I'm going to have to look under my car when I leave today.
So can I? I'm not touching John's thing, but I will riff a little bit off of that and say, I think I mentioned this a few weeks ago on the show, but I think it's a powerful argument, and that is, we need to ask ourselves why the Trump administration is so focused on cultural institutions like higher education and arts institutions like the Kennedy Center and so on. One plausible reason that they are focused on those institutions is because they are breeding grounds for democracy. They're not just breeding grounds for liberalism, but they're breeding grounds for democracy. You learn how to be a good citizen largely in college. You learn how to be critical of particular arguments in college. You mature intellectually, democratically, and so on in places like college. And so, as a result, I think it's a strategic move on the Trump administration's part to try its best to dismantle those institutions that are breeding grounds for democracy.
You also learn tolerance for different kinds of people at college.
Yeah.
Things you might not have learned in your small town growing up. The other thing, you get exposure to people from other countries,
right,
you know, and learn about different cultures. And it gives you a better understanding of the world's history and where you're coming from. It makes us all stronger.
Yeah. And I'll say one more thing, Joe. Judy reminded me exactly of this. One of the things that the Trump administration is claiming the Trump administration is claiming victory for is the fact that they got Columbia to agree that they would be largely neutral with regard to admissions qualifications. So the notion that somehow we need a diverse student body, the Trump administration is claiming victory because Columbia said, okay, we'll race neutral admissions policies. That, of course, the court said a few years ago in the Harvard case. So at some level, that's a hollow victory for both sides. Columbia is agreeing to something that the Supreme Court says is the law of the land. There's no win or loss there. And yet, watch. You'll see that the on Fox News and so on, the Trump administration will claim victory for something the Supreme Court says they can't do in the first place.
Actually, that's a good question, and I'll defer to you on this one, Beau, but I'm earnestly curious about it, because you're right. It is, you know, the law of the land. Yeah. But to what degree do we know, to what degree are universities, not just Columbia, but at large, abiding by it?
Well, so they're abiding by it. They're abiding by it in the what I would describe as the formal sense. Like, okay, you can no longer check a box on your admissions application. That said, what creatively and what Roberts, who wrote that opinion in the Harvard case, what Roberts allows is for other avenues, mm-hmm, with which to demonstrate, you know, that diversity was impactful in your life, and most schools are now using essays, okay, application essays, as a way to get at that particular question. So it's a little bit sidestep, but Roberts allowed that in his majority opinion.
Fair.
Part of the settlement requires Columbia to report back to the federal government about who they hire, yeah, and what how diverse or non-diverse they are. So they're keeping their thumb on them for a while.
When does the Barron Trump Campus Center open?
16 million there, too.
Let's go to more letters. We go to Jerry, who says, what about the rights of Palestinian students? As their families were being starved and slaughtered in Gaza, some students in Columbia were openly supporting their assassins. That from Jerry. We go to Anna. I'm curious if you feel that Black Lives Matter or Occupy Wall Street movements or any sit-in movements should be sued by the group they are protesting. Where does freedom of speech begin? Where does it end? Speaking nonviolent, of course, says Anna.
What was that famous line? Was it Brandeis about a famous Supreme Court justice about your right to swing your arm ends when it comes in contact with my nose? That's the answer.
Yeah, I'm not sure that was Brandeis. He was a little more erudite than that.
Yes. Well, you know,
Yeah, I mean the
but that earnestly, that is where you draw the line, right? When it becomes violent, when it turns into harassment and intimidation, then it's over the line. I don't think it's necessarily that hard of a line to draw.
Oh, I think it's a super complicated line to draw.
Yeah, when you use the word harassment, like that is spoken words can be very hard.
Point taken. Yeah. When you're restricting freedom of movement, as happened quite a lot. You know, you can't come through here, Jewish student. This is our, you know, pro-Palestinian encampment. That's crossing the line.
That's crossed the line. But Judy's right. The when you speak about something and you allow freedom of movement,
yeah,
is that crossing the line? It depends on where we are in the room. And my answer to that would be no.
Yeah, and look, for what it's worth, I know it may not sound like it, but I'm kind of a free speech absolutist, okay? I spent 20 years in the news media before I was in education. I take this seriously. But I also take seriously the right to go to college and not feel intimidated, to not feel like you don't belong there, and to have administration not have your back.
Oliver Wendell Holmes, your right to swing your fist ends where the other man's nose begins.
Okay, I was about 80% of the way there.
Holmes is great too, but Brandeis was the greatest.
Let's see. Let's go to this letter from Mike. Once the university administrations, Columbia, Harvard, et al., ceded the cynical premise that meaningful criticism of the state of Israel is per se anti-Semitic, they put themselves in a defensive posture from which they never recovered. Also, let's not continue to lie and dissemble about what happened at these campus protests. Nearly across the board, the vast majority of violence was actually perpetrated by counter-protesters. What happened to Mahmoud Khalil was not violence. What happened to Ozturk was that not violence. That is from Mike this morning. We
both.
Also, go ahead.
Both. They're both violent. Yes.
I, says John, would like to suggest that the gentleman who supports the Columbia, quote-unquote, settlement watch the Netflix documentary Turning Point about the Vietnam War, where the college students led the way. I saw my first anti-war protest in 1966, where college kids sat in a circle in Hyannis, Massachusetts, singing. It was high school. It was a high school grad party time. People, kids were kicking them and yelling at them. That from John. Then we go to Randy. Donald Trump called bankers Shylocks earlier this month. The anti-Semitism is coming from inside of the House. And anybody have anything else on that? All right, hearing none, we go to a new topic as we work our way up to the top of the hour. And we want to go to, I want to go to a story that's a little bit easier to digest before we go into a big
baseball.
One.
We're going
to
talk about
so Jeffrey's off the table.
I'm going to hold Epstein for a minute, I think. Let's do Hegseth signal messages coming from came from an email, classified secret. This is the story that keeps on giving as far as the press goes. This is an exclusive from the Washington Post that says the Pentagon's independent watchdog has received evidence that messages from Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth's signal account previewing a U.S. bombing campaign in Yemen. That seems so long.
Yeah. Doesn't it, though? I'd forgotten about this story. I've got to be honest.
Were derived from a classified email labeled secret. secret/no-forn, people familiar with the matter said. The revelation appears to contradict longstanding claims by the Trump administration that no classified information was divulged in unclassified group chats that critics have called a significant security breach. The messages about the bombing campaign posted in at least two group chats using the unclassified messaging app Signal are the focus of an inquiry by the Defense Department Inspector General's office requested in April by Republican and Democratic members of the Senate Armed Services Committee. The strike plans had been shared in a classified email with more than a dozen defense officials by General Michael Eric Carrilla, the top commander overseeing U.S. military operations in the Middle East, and then were posted in the unclassified group chats by an account affiliated with Hegseth on March 15th, shortly before the United States began attacking Houthi militants. The people familiar with the matter also said that the secret classification of Carrilla's email, which has not previously been reported, denoted that the information was classified at a level at which unauthorized disclosure could be expected to cause serious damage to national security. The NOFORN, N-O-F-O-R-N, label means it also was not meant for anyone who is a foreign national, including senior officials of close allies of the United States. In accordance with government regulations, Carrilla sent his sensitive message over a classified system, the secret internet protocol router network. Four people familiar with the matter said, speaking on the condition of anonymity, to avoid reprisal from the Trump administration. I feel I say that at least twice a day. Go ahead.
Of course it was classified. And we knew that back then. I mean, they're giving details about when they're going to bomb a city in the sites. Jeffrey Goldberg, the Atlantic editor, is sitting in a grocery store parking lot watching his phone saying, oh, my God, it's really happening. I mean, the only defense the Republicans were giving yesterday was no harm, no foul. I mean, no offense to cowboys, but you got a cowboy running the Department of Defense. And this is what the kind of things are going to happen. The question is how long President Trump is going to give him support and let him stay in the job.
Agreed. What I'll say in this regard, Judy and Joe, is, and Robert, is that the cult of personality is real, right? The first moment in which Hegseth. It was revealed that Hegseth had the signal chat. Should have been his last day in office. Now we're extending it with the knowledge that this was originally a secret email that has a particular label on it. He should go, but he won't. And I always go down the path of shame on Congress, and in particular the Senate here. Does a majority of Congress senators believe that Hegseth is a good choice or the right choice or even a reasonable choice as Secretary of Defense? The answer is no, but they're unwilling to stand up. The Senate is Republicans are unwilling to stand up against Trump's cult of personality, in part because they know, and Mitch McConnell was the king of this, they know that Trump carries with him the big donors. And so when the Senate Republicans need money for their campaigns, they have to be on the same side as Trump. And as a result, they can look the other way when somebody like Hegseth comes up and their job is to confirm or reject that candidate. Often, Joe, you've heard me say, often the blame for me goes to Congress because they are asleep at the wheel.
Robert.
Oy. Well, look, you know, national defense is not my forte. Hegseth, that said, would not have been my first choice for defense secretary. I'm not going to, you know, justify that choice or this handling of classified information. You know, that said, whatever you think of Hegseth's, you know, boneheaded signal screenshot, the larger story, I think, I hope, is that the U.S. and Israel have made real progress in the Middle East. And again, I'm not going to justify either the no harm, no foul, but there is a logic to it, right? We've deterred Iran. We've degraded its regional proxies, particularly the Houthis, who are not menacing global shipping the way they were just months ago. So, you know, again, I'm not the Trump apologist, but whatever you think of it, the Middle East, I believe, is in far better shape than it was a year ago. So we're talking about this instead. That's an unforced error. It is what it is. You know, you break it, you buy it, so to speak. If this is what Hegseth has done, he should be held accountable for it. But I also hope we don't lose sight of the larger story, which is, you know, the Middle East is being remade.
You thought this would be an easy conversation, Joe, and I know we don't have too much time, but I could not agree.
Oh, I didn't think it would be easy. All right. I just thought we could contain it easier.
I'm just not. I just don't agree that the Middle East is in a better state than it was a year ago. Right.
Okay.
And unfortunately,
tell me why you what you see that I don't see.
Well,
I always learn things on the round table.
Right. So I think that.
That's what we strive for, Robert.
Well, I think the situation in Israel and Gaza itself is more than just a disaster. And I'm not suggesting I'm all about Israel statehood and so on. I'm fully supportive Zionist in some many ways. That said, I'm also a two-state solution guy. And we are farther away from a two-state solution, John Kerry two-state solution today than we were a year ago. And in that regard, I think the Middle East is more destable than it was or unstable than it was a year ago.
Hamas, Hezbollah, the Houthis, yep. Iran denuclearized, these are not good things?
I think those are terrorist organizations and they should be... disarmed. That said, the problem for me is Netanyahu and his ultra-conservative right-wing group. I know this is not always popular with the listeners, but you know the reality is you're not going to Bibi is not going to put an organization into Gaza that will allow, like there is in the West Bank, that will allow for the possibility of a two-state conversation. Mm-hmm. And that, to me, strikes me as disappointing at best.
All right, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We have many other issues to discuss. But don't worry, the tenor will probably be the same. We'll do all of that right after this break. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Very nice to have you with us on this Thursday morning. Thank you very much, Robert. I appreciate it. It's hard to keep track sometimes. We welcome you and we thank you very much for being with us. Joseph Palamountain, Chair in Government at Skidmore College. Bo Breslin is here, former Vice President for Editorial Development at the New York Press Association and former editor of the Daily Gazette. Judy Patrick is here, and Senior Fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, Robert Pendicio, is here. And we welcome you. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. All right, so let's go to the Epstein matter and,
here we go.
Yeah, here we go. I've said this every day this week. I don't like this story.
but here we go again.
But I don't know. I don't know how, but how do you avoid it given the kerfuffle? And the ramifications of it. So here we go.
Yeah.
The Justice Department told Trump in May that his name is among many in the Epstein files. This is a report from the Wall Street Journal. You know, the newspaper that Trump sued over the weekend because of the last story, an exclusive that the Wall Street Journal did in regards to this story. When Justice Department officials reviewed what Attorney General Pam Bondi called a, quote, truckload of documents related to Jeffrey Epstein earlier this year, they discovered that Donald Trump's name appeared multiple times, according to senior administration officials. In May, Bondi and her deputy informed the president at a meeting in the White House that his name was in the Epstein files. The officials say many other high-profile figures were also named. Being mentioned in the records is not a sign of wrongdoing. The official said it was a routine briefing that covered a number of topics and that Trump's appearance in the documents was not the focus. They told the president at the meeting that the files contained what officials felt was unverified hearsay about many people, including Trump, who had socialized with Epstein in the past, some of the officials said. One of the officials familiar with the documents said that they contain hundreds of other names. They also told Trump that senior Justice Department officials didn't plan to release any more documents related to the investigation of the convicted sex offender because the material contained child pornography and victims' personal information. Trump said at the meeting he would defer to the Justice Department's decision to not release any further files. The meeting set the stage for the high-profile review to come to an end. Bondi had said in February that Epstein's client list was sitting on my desk right now to review, quote-unquote. Trump said last week in response to a journalist's question that Bondi hadn't told him that his name was in the files. The administration didn't publicly announce the decision until weeks later on July 7th when the Justice Department posted a memo on its website. The statement, which was unsigned, stated that a thorough review had turned up no list of Epstein's clients, no evidence that would lead to an investigation of uncharged third parties, and no additional documents that merited public disclosure. Okay, so if you're all up to date on that, let me go.
But wait, there's more.
Well, so then the Speaker of the House about 10 days ago said, we need to get to the bottom of this and we have to find more document and get to the bottom of this. And then never mind, let's all go home. President Donald Trump was struggling Wednesday to contain the fallout from his administration's decision not to release the Epstein files as a House subcommittee for the first time voted to subpoena the administration for the files and a Florida court declined to release grand jury testimony from the case. Three House Republicans supported a measure introduced by Representative Summer Lee of Pennsylvania, a Democrat, to demand the Justice Department release the files. Under House rules, the full committee, led by Representative James Comer, a Republican of Kentucky, a Trump ally, must now issue the subpoenas. Subpoenas will be issued in the near future, an oversight spokesman said last night. The oversight panel also voted to subpoena all communications about Epstein between then-President Joe Biden and his administration, as well as to subpoena a long list of other prominent figures from Democratic and Republican administrations, including, listen to this list, Bill and Hillary Clinton, former FBI Director James Comey, former Attorney General Merrick Garland, William Barr, Jeff Sessions, Loretta Lynch, Eric Holder, Alberto Gonzalez, as well as former Special Counsel Robert Mueller. And it's unclear why lawmakers felt those officials would be instrumental to hear from, though the federal investigation into Epstein spans two decades and several presidential administrations. And the cracks starting to emerge in the GOP coalition signaled the firestorm over Epstein has far from abated and may intensify as Republicans hear from voters at home during their five-week August recess.
I'll jump in because like the story until last night, and now I love it.
Really?
And I'll tell you why. I
can't wait to hear what you're going to say.
So this show, Joe, your show does a very good job of reminding folks why we're here, right? Why is this different? Why is the Epstein story different? Well, there are a couple of reasons why the Epstein story is different. The MAGA Republicans, for the most part, believe that the deep state is dangerous, mm-hmm. right? The deep state is dangerous. And this is more QAnon, but more MAGA Republicans are starting to support the idea that only Trump can save America from the deep state.
Yeah.
You add child pornography, which is the cardinal sin, into the equation, Epstein, and Trump is associated with the cardinal sin that Trump is supposed to be the white knight coming in and saving us all from. So I looked up data. 7 out of 10 Americans think that the current government is covering up the Epstein information. 84% of Democrats believe that. That's not surprising. But 53% of Republicans believe that the current administration is covering up Epstein information. And that goes to the heart of the MAGA Republicans' belief that Trump is the savior, right? Mm-hmm. So if he's covering up, his name is in it, in the file, and he's associated with both child pornography, but also with the idea that he's part of the deep state, you are rattling a lot of MAGA Republicans. So the reality is, think about the impeachments, right? So these are the moments in which Trump sort of failed America. The two impeachments back in his first administration are over one, the quid pro quo with Zelensky, right? He gets on the phone and he sort of has this quid pro quo conversation and he gets impeached for that. And two, the January 6th insurrection. Both of those, the MAGA Republicans have turned into positives, right? So Zelensky, the quid pro quo with Zelensky is just the art of the deal. It's Trump doing what he does best, right? He's trying to figure out how to work with Zelensky. And the January 6th revolution is Trump being strong, right? Trump, the insurrection itself is being strong. This moment is the first time that I can remember the Epstein stuff, where Trump is at the center of something that the MAGA Republicans are scratching their heads and saying he's not strong, mm-hmm. he's not doing a deal and all that sort of stuff, and he's mired in it. So I actually think the story is bigger, and I will defer to the three other people on the panel, but I do, Joe, want to talk about, A, the Democrats' response to that, because Akeem Jeffries had a response to it that I think is super interesting for the future of the Democratic Party. And also, I do think it's important that folks know about conspiracy theories. I have this, I want to talk a tiny bit at some point about the fact that conspiracy theories have always been at the heart of the American political experiment. Mm-hmm. I'll leave it at that.
That's a nice segue to the one observation that I want to make, Bo. And by the way, you just described perfectly why this story, alas, is not going to go away. There's too much investment in it. The Democrats have, you know, Trump on the ropes on this. Your point about MAGA Republicans is exactly right. You know, hey, this is the guy we elected to lift the lid off the deep state. So now it's like, and so for the 347th time, okay, this is the thing that's going to bring him down, right? It's not going to end with anyone's satisfaction because of the conspiracy theory aspect of this. I mean, 60 odd years later, we're still, you know, arguing about, you know, who killed Kennedy or whatnot. I mean, the one rejoinder to the Hakeem Jeffries thing, not a rejoinder, just an observation. Byron Donalds, the guy who's running for governor in Florida, he's a congressman from Florida, made the point, and I think he's exactly right. Like, look, if there was a way to get Trump in these files, then why wouldn't it have come out during the Biden administration? So my and I'm not a cynic, but it's hard not to be cynical about this entire thing. I don't think this ends. I don't think it ends, period. But I sure as heck don't think it ends to anyone's satisfaction with a smoking gun. We gotcha. But my fearless prediction, Joe, is every time I'm going to be on the roundtable between now and when the sun goes out, we'll probably be talking about this.
Yeah, and I just want it to be go on the record that I'm not for that.
Thomas,
I just want to read something because it made me mad, but I want to.
Nobody has an incentive to let this go. Is the point?
Correct. And I have said this day after day, but I still there's many aspects of the story I simply don't understand. and I don't think I ever will. This one comes from Jeffrey and says, Joe, that Epstein case is not a kerfuffle. It is about pedophilia. It is about sex trafficking. We need to stop minimizing this story. I am not minimizing sexual trafficking. I am not sex trafficking. I am not minimizing pedophilia. What I say is a kerfuffle is this back and forth between the Republicans and the Democrats and how they are going to handle this. A kerfuffle is when you say, this is our schedule. We're going to go home on this day. No, never mind. We're going to go home on this day. And that is the kerfuffle I'm talking about. So please don't put words in my mouth and say that I'm calling this overall issue a kerfuffle. This is a back and forth political football now that I think you're right. We're going to be talking about this for a very, very long time. And I think that is very unfortunate for so many reasons. Judy.
So there are a lot of twists and turns to this story, a lot of layers. So as an old journalist, I would look at this in two ways. So let's look at the criminal aspect of this. Jeffrey Epstein's island was in the U.S. Virgin Islands, U.S. territory. Many girls, let's call them what they are, girls. They're not young women. They were girls who were sexually abused at that island by many men. No other man has ever been charged with anything in connection with the abuse that happened at that island. Why is that? That is a question. Also, another question is, how did Jeffrey Epstein get his money? Let's follow the money here and figure out what was fueling his extravagant lifestyle and his ability. Experts say he was no expert financier, even though that's how he is described. So those are real issues. You are not the reasonable release of, the Biden administration, Merrick Garland's Justice Department had this case. Their first Trump administration had this case. But let's not forget, but way back when, in Florida, Epstein was given basically a slap on the hand for his earlier transgressions. So he has had a smooth ride in terms of criminality. Again, young women, young girls were abused, and nobody has been held accountable. And they're out there, and they're still suffering. And you know, Julie K. Brown, the reporter
yes.
who broke this story for the Miami Herald, she talks about the fact that they are still dealing with the after effects of this. It's all salacious. Back during for a long time, the Democrats didn't want to talk about this because they thought Democrat Democratic power brokers were involved or were on the list or whatever. And so it became a political football. And now we're seeing the political football where it's not so much that the MAGA people believe that maybe Trump was involved in this. They believe he's being manipulated. At one point over the weekend, it felt like the MAGA people were turning on Trump, but then they started to turn back after the Wall Street Journal article, the first one about the birthday card, because they thought, oh, look at this. The deep state is turning on him. We are going to support him. I think this is not going to go away. Trump, he typically manages to manage his supporters much better than this. And his reaction to what's happening is one of the reasons that's fueling the continued stories. I mean, the fact that, you know, he had Pam Bondi release the folders to the super influencers or the mega influencers. And then on a Sunday afternoon, he releases something that says, we're not going to see anything more. We're done. There's nothing to prosecute. Clearly, there's something to prosecute because all these people were abused. He's fueling this at this point, and the Democrats are seizing on the issue. Yeah. I mean, that's what they do. The fact that the Republicans are coming in to support him, it's interesting.
This is foundational for MAGA, right? In other words, why is Donald Trump in power? Because boxcar numbers of Americans believe that there's a cabal of powerful people who are self-dealing and unaccountable, and Trump said himself, I am your retribution. Well, maybe not, right? So it's no mystery to me why the MAGA right will not let this go, because this is almost like a creation myth for the MAGA right. So they are disappointed because the guy that they voted for to lift the lid off this has failed them.
Yeah, let me say, first of all three of my fellow panelists agree with me that, Judy, what you said about, you know, let's not lose sight of, you know, let's keep our eyes on the prize. There were girls who were assaulted. So hear, hear. Thank you for saying that. Mm-hmm. I'm a political scientist, so let's talk politics. And the reality is, so I was very curious about the Democrats' response to this. And what happened was a very interesting, I don't know if you guys saw it, a very interesting press conference where Akeem Jeffries comes out and he says he ties the Epstein story to the old and quite frankly tired Democratic argument that, you know, we're burying stuff because we're supporting the rich, right? The Trump administration is all about protecting the rich, and so we're going to bury Epstein's story and so on. But what was interesting about that, this was last night or yesterday afternoon, what was interesting about that press conference was that Catherine Clark, number two in charge of the Democratic Party in Congress, Congresswoman from Massachusetts, comes out and immediately follows Akeem Jeffries and starts to talk conspiracy theory, right? So what I was thinking at the time is, and I've said this before, will the Democrats ever understand that the game of politics has changed? You cannot use conventional, in this environment, you cannot use conventional messages, conventional standards to win elections, especially at the presidential level anymore. And they have to think different. The Democrats have to think differently about the way they message. And so Akeem Jeffries has the old and conventional method. Catherine Clark is playing a different game, playing a Trumpian game about this is a conspiracy. There are conspiracies. Don't forget the child pornography and so on. She's playing at a low level. What I'll say is Democrats, this is a really tough moment for Democrats because Democrats want to play the high ground when it comes to politics. MAGA Republicans don't necessarily want to play the high ground. That's why we have QAnon and so on. But Democrats want to stay on the high ground and think of politics as, you know, an intellectual, erudite, liberal, left-wing sort of thing.
Wait, this is your advice to the Democrats?
No, I'm saying Democrats want to play that, but the game is so dramatically changed that they need to figure out how to still play that high ground, we're moral, and so on. and still win campaigns in an environment where one out of two Americans believe in genuine conspiracy theories. So all I'm saying is it's very interesting the way I see the Democratic Party, Hakeem Jeffries doing the traditional message, Catherine Clark doing a more unconventional message for Democrats. They're sort of shifting and seeing the game of politics differently.
Where do you think this, because I agree, once again, I agree with Robert, who says, you know, we're going to be talking about this for a long time. But you do wonder where it's going to go, because Trump seems to just be simmering on it, and it's driving him nuts. And meanwhile, more and more information is leaking and coming out. And we're finding out more of what's in the reports and what and Pam Bondi has reported and so forth. And I'm interrupting myself, but I mean I read that story about Pam Bondi three times last night. And I was like, okay, but so what happened? Like it just was.
I don't know why she still has her job, to be honest. In other words, and it's, you know, she's lying in the bed that she made when she said, oh, that list is on my desk right now. Well, where is it? Either were you lying then or you're lying now? Either there's no list or you're not releasing it.
I agree with you. I also just don't understand the fact that you say that you're in the files.
To be honest, that's not a surprise, right?
Well, that's what I mean. That's what I mean. Why is that a story? Like, we knew that.
That's right.
Yeah, that, and that,
there's no
that's
mystery
what I'm saying.
That they had a relationship until 2005.
Any files that get released are going to be so heavily redacted as to be meaningless. I mean, they're just going to be anything that you really want to know are going to be. You might get the salacious details of what happened when and where, but all the names are going to be crossed out.
And you saw what Alan Dershowitz wrote, right? I think it was also in the journal where I think that you discussed it last week on the roundtable, didn't you, Joe?
Yes.
About I've seen the list, or not the list, but I've seen all the evidence and
yes,
yeah.
And Joe, I would say one quick thing here is that there's a fascinating article.
30 seconds.
Yep, 30 seconds. Fascinating article in Politico this morning in which they talk about what happened behind the scenes in the Republican caucus in Congress. Mike Johnson just wants to stall for a few more days until folks can literally go home. The subpoenas was the big problem for him. He wants to stall, and then he's hoping that August is an opportunity for the White House to get a more solid message so that it come September, he can manage it with Congress at that point. That's what I think is going to happen. And he's been a very effective speaker.
We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable. And to our panel discussions this morning, our discussion overall, we are having a series of discussions. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org. Couple letters and we'll move on. Rosemary says the story should be about the victims, the young girls who are hardly mentioned. Marie says, I hope that the Dems can chew a large wad of bubblegum and walk at the same time. We are at recess. The talk needs to be the big, beautiful bill first, then Epstein. All is important. Another major distraction plan from the White House. Then we go to...
It's an interesting... Can I comment on that?
Yeah, of course.
That story, that letter?
Yes.
It's interesting because I think the Democrats are thinking about switching that and making Epstein their biggest message in the next short term.
Yeah.
And the big, beautiful bill secondary to that. I think that's a mistake, but I think they're thinking of switching it.
Let's see.
And by the way, Bo, I think you're right. Why are they thinking of switching it? Because this is the thing that is going to bring down Trump. This is the thing that divides him from his base.
Right.
There you go.
This is the biggest wedge that they've had in a while.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is the thing that's going to get them the midterms.
Yeah.
I think that's what they're all focused on. But I agree with you. I think it's wrong. I think they overestimate people's interest in the Epstein case.
I think that's right.
There are some people who really care about it, but there are other people that don't.
Have any of you had a conversation with a real person in the real world, not on Twitter or X, about this? I haven't.
Oh, my beautiful wife, Martha.
Okay.
Only in the sense of the eye rolling of, oh my God, we're talking about this again.
This feels to me like an obsession of the very online, both right and left.
Okay. Is your panelist? They're all my panelists. Is your panelist saying that since Republicans exploit conspiracy theories, Democrats should do the same? Isn't that feeding the misinformation and skepticism that is eroding our political system?
Yep. Wow, I can't tee it up better than that, Joe. So let me, I love, this is one of my favorite things. I'm not a conspiracy theorist. I'm one of the one out of two.
But he plays one on the round table.
Yeah, I play one on the round table. But let's not forget that America was born on conspiracy theories, and I literally mean that. The reality was that a lot of the Revolutionary War propaganda was about the British conspiracy that were trying to get at us. The Declaration of Independence itself is a conspiratorial document. And the greatest conspiracy, insofar as, Robert, you define conspiracies as, or was it Joe, small cabal of people who sort of see a worldview in a particular way, is the Constitutional Convention, right? They go to Philadelphia largely with the idea that they're going to amend the Articles of Confederation, and they rip it up. There's no greater conspiracy. Now, here's where it gets to be interesting, because there's a great book, and it's called Some People Are Saying by Russ Muirhead and Nancy Rosenblum. It's a great book about conspiracies. And what they argue in that particular book is that we have lost sight of the importance of conspiracies in America. There was a time, Revolutionary War all the way through to the last, say, generation, there was a time when conspiracy theories were useful for America because it created an opportunity for a different worldview, right? So when the Americans were writing about British conspiracies, they had an idea of independence. When the Constitutional Convention delegates were ripping up the Articles of Confederation, they had an idea about a greater America. When Thomas Jefferson was he had a surrogate writing conspiracies about John Adams, it was because he wanted to create the utopian agrarian society. You go all the way through the Civil War and the 20th century, conspiracies have been part of American society, but there's always been a goal. The problem with the last generation and with the Trump administration is that instead of world-building conspiracies, they are world-destroying conspiracies. They are not the conspiracies that come out of the Trump administration are meant to damage America, and there's no greater utopian worldview that they have. And so we've lost sight of the importance of conspiracies as moving the needle on a more perfect union.
I'm not asking you to defend MAGA thought, Bo, but that's fascinating.
QAnon is a world-destroying conspiracy.
Well, no, where I was going to go with that is it not? Is there not a logic to thinking, okay, look, you know, we have an unresponsive government; it's being run by a self-dealing cabal or group of elites, etc. Bringing that down is not a building block?
I mean, but replacing it, this is what I'm talking about, where the historical figures had an idea of replacement that was seen as better. Bringing down the existing deep state cabal and replacing it with another cabal strikes me as not.
Oh, okay, well, yeah, you're assuming that the goal was to replace it with a cabal as opposed to
an aristocracy or an oligarchy is what the Trump administration would like. That kind of replacement, I'm not so sure we would want.
Oh, no question. But this is why I'm not a populist.
Okay, let's go to I believe our final story for this morning. I think we can get this in good time, that has to do with the U.S. Planning to end PEPFAR, and this is a story that has been around and sort of. I mean, not really rumored. I think there were various drafts, and this is another one that the federal program to combat HIV in developing nations earned a reprieve last week when Congress voted to restore $400 million in funding. But that may be short-lived, as officials at the State Department have been mapping out a plan to shut it down in the coming years. Planning documents for the president's emergency plan for AIDS relief, obtained by the New York Times, calls for the organization to set a new course that focuses on, quote, transitioning countries away from U.S. assistance, some in as little as 2 years. PEPFAR, as the program is called, would cease to exist as an initiative to provide medicines and services needed to treat and prevent the spread of HIV in low-income countries. It would be replaced by, quote, bilateral relationships with low-income countries focused on the detection of outbreaks that could threaten the United States and the creation of new markets for American drugs and technologies, according to the released documents, or the documents reviewed by the New York Times. With targeted investment, PEPFAR's HIV control capabilities in these countries could be transformed into a platform for rapid detection and outbreak response to protect Americans from disease threats like Ebola, the plan says. A State Department spokesman said that the document had not been finalized. The reference document is not reflective of the State Department's policy on PEPFAR and was never cleared by the leadership of the department.
Isn't this so sad? It's all about us. You know, we'll get involved as long as we're protecting ourselves. The other thing here is that they got the support of some important senators for passage of the Big Beautiful Bill based on the continued funding for PEPFAR. And, you know, it's a classic case where Trump said, and Columbia should have learned a lesson from this. I mean, you cannot take them at their word. Lisa Murkowski, you learned the same lesson. This is one of George Bush's proudest achievements, I think, is this program, which has saved tens of millions of lives. But apparently, we in America, we only care about ourselves going forward, and it makes me ashamed to support this kind of government. I have to, because this is the people that Americans have elected. But wow, the things that are being done in our name are just atrocious.
PEPFAR, President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief. So, and this is not a defense. I agree with you, Judy. Calling it an emergency plan implies in its very name that it's time limited, that this is not, you know, an ongoing department or program or whatnot. So it's not necessarily a surprise that they want to revise or replace it. But no, you're right. This is foolishness. This is not some, you know, bloated globalist initiative. It's a program that was launched by a Republican president, supported by evangelicals, foreign policy hawks, fiscal conservatives for 2 decades. And I assume it's not going away, by the way. But this does. And again, this is not a defense. But given that this administration seems to be, rightly or wrongly, saying, OK, what is the proper role of the federal government? You know, everything from this to public broadcasting. Is this a legitimate federal function? Yes or no? I don't begrudge them asking those questions. Those are appropriate questions to ask. But this strikes me as one that we need to keep doing.
Yeah. So it's a straight out of the Project 2025 playbook, where, Project 2025, the USAID chapter, speaks very clearly about the fact that we are going to wind down things like PEPFAR and other similar soft power, health-related policies in exchange for focusing on other things. Now, what I think is what I find hypocritical is the claim on the part of the Trump administration to be isolationist, right? So the reality is we were supposed to be. The broader idea is that we're getting out of foreign aid, foreign policy, because we're isolationist. We're all about supporting America and so on. So we're only going to touch those diseases that might cross our borders. But when we are, it's selective isolationism, and I'm not suggesting that you can just go cold turkey, but selective isolationism, because Trump is still desperately trying to get the Nobel Peace Prize for his involvement in some of these other places around the world. But no, when we talk about the global South, somehow that isn't that doesn't rise to the level and support, you know, figuring out a way in which to provide healthcare for AIDS patients in the global South doesn't rise to the level. So I think there's hypocrisy, but it's right out of the Project 2025 playbook.
All right, we are done for today. My thanks to everybody for being with us. I appreciate all of your thoughts and for your respect and for listening to each other and to our listeners. We would love to, we want to thank all the people who checked in as well. Anybody got anything else? I have 12 seconds.
Enjoy this wonderful summer weather.
Yes.
It won't last.
Yeah.
Winter is coming.
That's right. Winter is definitely coming. Judy Patrick, Bo Breslin, Robert Pondicio, thank you very much. You're all wonderful. I appreciate it. We'll be back right after this.